This is Afshin Ratansian of On Ridley joining you from on board HMS President in the heart of the English capital.
And the theme today is how individuals and nations are coping with the backlash of natural and man-made disasters of seismic proportions.
We look at how the Japanese people are coping with life after the earthquakes and tsunami which brought chaos into their lives, and compare and contrast how Western and Japanese media reacted.
And this guest fears a massive backlash in Pakistan after CIA contractor Raymond Davis returns to America, a free man just days after being indicted with the murder of two Pakistanis.
And it's anyone's guess what the consequences are going to be after the People's Revolution in Bahrain took a dramatic new turn when Saudi sent 1,000 troops to patrol the streets in Manama and beyond.
And as the troops moved in, one Bahrain dissident returned to London with first-hand tales of torture and abuse he experienced in prison over there.
All of this and so much more, so stay tuned to the show which rocks the boat. Our first guest is Lord Nasir Ahmed, the first Muslim to enter the House of Lords, which was a great source of pride for Pakistanis home and abroad.
However, pride is not a word linked with Pakistan these days, after it appears a cash deal was done to secure the release of CIA contractor Raymond Davis, who was arrested in January after he allegedly shot dead two men in Lahore.
Lord Nasir Ahmed, welcome to HMS President. What sort of backlash are you expecting in Pakistan?
Well, it's a bizarre situation that you've got a man who was involved in espionage, a friendly country that was spying on Pakistan. He kills two people, and then they pay 20 crores, which is like $2.5 million, to the family. 19 members go into the court and say that they're withdrawing the case, and he's on the next flight to Afghanistan. And quite frankly, people are appalled that this has happened in Pakistan, when a man has shot dead two Pakistanis on the streets of Lahore. Very clearly, all the evidence is that he was involved in spying on military installations, and he's just bought
his
way.
Well, you're saying that he shot them dead. I mean, really, until there was a trial, we wouldn't really know the full facts, and the trial was denied. But is it right that America turned to Sharia law for a solution here?
Absolutely. This is a bizarre situation. Again, that Americans have resorted to Sharia law and paid the money. And they are saying now, well, this is a Pakistani law. And so, you know, when it suits them, they can use Sharia law and say it's a Pakistani law. So we will buy it, we will use it, and we will abuse it, of course. But, you know, there is precedent in Pakistan that even when people have used Sharia law in Peshawar court and they've given money, the judges have not accepted that. Now, you have a very clear statement from one of the dead men's widow who's committed suicide. She said she didn't want money. She wanted that person to be, she wanted either a revenge or for him to serve the sentence. And quite frankly, the court didn't have the authority to do it.
But what does it say about the Pakistani judiciary, let alone President
Well, it's
Obama?
Not only judiciary. I think the society, the government, and there's a very clear split. The government is trying to corner the military by being more loyal to America than even the Americans themselves. And then you have the judiciary, who is subservient to lots of other people. I think there are lots of deals made.
And now, do you think the ISI made a deal with the CIA?
I don't think so. I think the ISI has been sidelined on this particular issue because there was espionage spying case. This is very clearly in contradiction with their own agreements with CIA. You can't spy. Just imagine if ISI was spying on CIA, what would they do to them? Would they be happy about that? I don't think so.
Or if somebody had was accused of shooting two American citizens in New York.
Well, you know, Afia Siddiqui was allegedly had attacked these Americans. She'd never shot them. The Americans shot them. She's serving 85-year prison sentence in the United States. I actually offered this to the State Department. I actually offered it, and I'm sure they'll be watching this program. I said that it would have been good if Afia Siddiqui had been released. She could have served her sentence in Pakistan. they could have taken this gentleman back in and let him work in the CIA department and claim that he was serving a prison sentence or whatever. This would have satisfied the people, and you wouldn't have had the anti-American feeling now for days to come or years to come. But what's important is that when there's this war on terror, you're going to create extra 4,000, 3,000 people who will then stand up and say, well, we're not going to let Americans do this to our country. And if we have to fight our own soldiers and our own government to fight with the Americans, they'll do it. This is very unfortunate.
Let alone the geopolitical concerns, though. Is there any recourse for the widows or other people in the family?
Well, you know, but what's going to happen? I mean, I think most of those members of the family will be taken to the United States and settled over there anyway, because that's the deal that seems like that's taken place. But what's worse is by tomorrow, they will be, and I pray to God that there's no violence on the streets of Pakistan.
Well, we'll be watching closely. Thank you very much, Lord Nazir.
Few could have failed to be moved by the devastating scenes caused by the earthquake, tsunami and nuclear crisis to hit Japan. The death toll is running in the thousands, still more than 10,000 missing, presumed dead.
I popped into the Japanese embassy to see how they were coping and spoke to the First Secretary, Daisuke Tsuchiya, and this is what he told me.
As you say, this is an unprecedented earthquake in terms of magnitude. And it has definitely been a shock for many people in Japan. At the same time, one, we are used to earthquakes. So we have had a lot of natural disasters in the past. So we have been involved in a lot of drills. You do drills at school. Evacuation procedures are in place. And also, our government sent in a lot of relief forces, including our self-defense forces, emergency services, running up to almost 70,000 currently. So I believe the sort of response to try to rescue as many people as possible, this was, I think, something that was executed with a lot of urgency, both on the government side as well as among the people. We were trying to cope with the situation.
Of course, we saw that within hours of the natural disaster in New Orleans, there was robbing, raping, looting, a breakdown of society. And this is something that we haven't seen happen in Japan, a breakdown of law and order.
We are grateful for this situation, I think. As you say, so far as we are aware, we have not heard of any severe looting or any riots going on in Japan. People are, of course, they find shortage in goods, but they are queuing up at supermarkets to buy them. And I think there is a sense in Japan of resilience. It's a time of great trouble, but it's also a time where we need to come together to try to cope with this terrible situation.
Of course, the Japanese media has handled the story in a very composed manner, compared, some would say, to the Western media, whose headlines have been bordering on sensationalism, if not hysteria. What was your view?
Well, I have to say, of course, each the media has its own right and freedom to portray the situation as it finds it. What I would say is, of course, in this terrible situation, it is important to ensure that the facts go out. And what we are trying to do as the Japanese government is to provide as much information, confirmed information, as possible, as quickly as possible to our people so that they do know what the situation is. It's, of course, an ongoing situation with a lot of change going on, but we are trying our best to do that.
Looking at the nuclear issues again, the media has been talking about Chernobyl and the Three Mile disaster in America. Are there any comparisons, or is this contained?
Well, it's a situation which always has the possibility of change. As a government, we are doing our very best, taking all measures possible to try to contain and minimize the damage done. Of course, in terms of earthquakes, we are a very earthquake-prone country. So we have had experiences of earthquakes, and we've put in the technology that we have at our hands to try to contain this situation as far as possible. We will continue to do that, and hopefully we will be able to do that.
And how has the Japanese diaspora been? How many Japanese are living in Britain, and what has their response been so far?
There's about 60,000 Japanese in the UK, and ever since the earthquake and tsunami occurred, we've had calls coming in from a lot of the people here, and it's quite, I feel it very touching how Japanese nationals who usually would not associate themselves that much with Japan itself are coming together right now. They are trying to organize charity events to raise money to send to the people back in Japan. Of course, we live far away, so everyone is trying to do what they can do to support those afflicted back in Japan.
First Secretary, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And from the natural and man-made disasters of Japan, we move to the political tsunami caused by the arrival of troops from Persian Gulf countries to Bahrain.
Our next guest gives his view on the backlash and talks about his own experiences inside prison in Bahrain for 6 months. Welcome, Jafar Hassabi. So what did you do to get locked up for so long?
They accused us with to be a member in a terrorist group. And it is all false, and it is just accusing people because we are protesting against them, we are marching against them, we are talking to media, and thus this is simply what...
When you got to Britain, were you surprised that it was the British and the Americans that, of course, were supporting the government that you were against?
No, they are supporting them, still they are supporting them, and even today and yesterday with the killing, and they are very strong ally to them. So they didn't even mention they are killing the people in the street, and nobody...
It's starting to change a little. I don't know whether you're surprised about that, but certainly when the Saudi troops went over the causeway, what did you feel?
It is scary for all people, and as you know, that they are not letting anybody to go out right now, and we can see some people are injured, and they leave them injured, bleeding on the street, and nobody is taking them. Even the hospital being surrounded by police and...
It's being covered on Press TV, the shooting of doctors, apparently.
Yeah.
But are you surprised that the Bahraini government would do things even without Washington's consent, apparently? Because even Hillary Clinton was speaking against an ally where they dock the Fifth Fleet.
Well, it is not strange. They are allied to American government, and they will be still allied, and they will never took this brutal regime from power.
Well, of course, Bahrain is home to the Fifth or the Sixth Fleet?
Fifth Fleet, yeah.
So do you think that these are just weasel words and politicians playing a game?
It is. They are playing a game. They just want to... make this royal family do whatever they do, and they just support them behind.
The Saudi troops have now been joined by officers from Qatar and another unit from the United Arab Emirates. So the GCC seems to be coming together in support of Bahrain. How much of a blow is that to the protesters?
Well, it is... Now we are invaded by Saudis and the other GCC members. We are as a people, we are peacefully demonstrating, we are calling for our rights, for our freedom.
What do you think of the reporting? Because it's being said in the West, this is a Shia-Sunni split and that's what it's all about.
If they are Shia, they should have been killed, and they don't have the legitimacy to call for their rights.
What are the demands?
The demands is, I think after the massacre, what they did, the people, they don't want the regime. They just want to remove the regime itself.
Well, let's see if they fulfill their ambitions. Jafar, thank you so much for coming on board.
International defence analyst Paul Beaver, who has worked with the British government, says he wasn't entirely surprised by the military intervention in Bahrain. Here he explains why.
We have a very interesting situation in the Gulf at the moment. I think Bahrain is a classic example of how the problems that between Sunni and Shia can be used by both sides in order to escalate probably a sort of a standoff at the moment. To me, the most interesting fact is that the Gulf Cooperation Council have actually put themselves together, and we now do have a case of a member, Bahrain, being supported by Saudi, very easy for them, drive across the causeway, but also United Arab Emirates and other nations in the GCC have supported the current administration in Bahrain. To me, it's fundamentally very simple that other Sunni monarchs in the Gulf will not allow a Sunni monarch, as in the King of Bahrain, to go under, to be dictated to. So they will protect that Sunni monarch. So to me, quite straightforward. What's difficult is seeing how the West will react to that, because the West traditionally likes democracy. For the West, they've had some real problems with democracy, because when you have democracy, you sometimes find that the people you don't like or can't work with get elected. Hamas in Palestine is a classic example of that.
Of course, there are those who say that this will put Saudi Arabia and Iran on a collision course.
If you look at the history of the Shia minority in Saudi Arabia, go back to the 70s and 80s, the area around Dhahran, there were some real problems there. And the monarchy, the Saudi monarchy in Riyadh, came under huge pressure. I think everyone would admit now that the Saudis were discriminating against the Shia in the east of Saudi Arabia. And a lot has been done since then to restore the balance, in effect. But there is a fundamental problem across the Gulf. On the western shore, you have predominantly monarchies, predominantly Sunni, with an attitude which is supportive of the West, which is very much about developing the country in the way that they want to. On the eastern shore of the Gulf, you have Iran, an Islamic Republic, which has a different view with a different strain of Islam. To Brits, to people in Western Europe watching this, there seems to be a real problem. You have allegations of occupations of areas, and the Tum Islands and Abu Musa, for example, in the Gulf. Lots of problems there. But at the end of the day, neither Saudi Arabia nor the Islamic Republic of Iran can afford a war over something that's happening there. A political solution has to be found. That political solution is perhaps not helped by either an intifada situation, insurrection, nor, for that matter, by the occupation of one country by another. The Saudis will have to demonstrate to the world that they've gone into Bahrain at the invitation of the government, but they will be able to withdraw in a matter of weeks once the situation is stabilized and not stay there. I don't think anybody in the Gulf wants to see the situation that we had in Iraq, where we had a de facto occupation by the United States and its allies. I don't think that did anyone any good. I don't think at the end of the day that solved any of the international problems associated with Iraq. So you have a real dichotomy now. Saudi has to demonstrate that it is just doing some peacekeeping, just supporting the monarchy, and will withdraw and not antagonize Iran. And Iran has to also just sit and watch this happen and make sure that it doesn't antagonize Saudi. Last thing we need is another conflict in that part of the world.
Paul Beaver, thank you very much.
American novelist Sarah Blake's latest work is about the first female war correspondents. Let's look at how 21st century counterparts fare compared to those in the 40s.
Her observations come at a time when journalists are being killed and injured in the line of duty. Welcome, Sarah. Now, your book is about a Second World War journalist.
That's right. Frankie Bard is a fictional radio correspondent who comes over to broadcast the Blitz for Edward R. Murrow at a time where women were very much not on the radio. But she wants to get the story of what's happening in order to get America to pay attention.
And as part of your research for this book, what did you notice about the difference between the coverage then of women war correspondents to their male counterparts?
Well, one of the things that was fascinating was that because women were definitely not welcomed on board to the press corps, many of them had to make a virtue out of necessity. Women were not prevented from reporting combat. They were not allowed to go any farther than front than the nurses. They had to file their reports after the men. They were not given transport. So women such as Martha Gellhorn found herself haunting the hospitals. And I think in many ways that's the kind of war reporting that now we take for granted, very much, you know, the talking to people of the effects of war rather than being with the soldiers in combat. So that in some senses I think began with women entering the press corps and not being allowed to go forward. And so, telling the stories of the people and the cost of war that way.
Do you think in a way it was a golden age? I mean, these names are so famous, Martha Gellhorn, Edward Murrow, whereas now, whether it's female or male, there's a corporate nature anyway to reporting.
Well, the thing is how to get across these human, individual, tiny stories that can convey a whole world. And I think it does seem like radio or... there is a corporatization in that there's a sense of like a kind of ideology behind many broadcast stations.
And but Gellhorn was very politicized.
She was very politicized, but she
and
was...
And arguably Murrow as
and
well.
And Murrow, so. Too. But they were, they I think, were they knew how to reduce something that was quite abstract into tiny stories. And so that was the way to get people emotionally involved. I mean, that's, you know, they were
appealing to that. You don't think, say, I don't know, Helen Thomas, of course, you know,
right?
D.C. very well.
Yes, yes.
The way she's been treated from time to time amongst the Washington press corps. Do you think women are still treated differently?
I think women would argue that that's true. You know,
what
that
about
still
the arenas
club.
That they're covering now? Is it more dangerous now for journalists than it was, say, covering a war 30, 40 years ago?
Clearly so. I mean, it seems that journalists are targeted now. They're, and they themselves are a kind of prize of war. And women, I mean, you know, the story with Laura Logan exemplifies that. I think, you know, the women of the 40s were very much, you know, coming across. They were pioneers just to push the door open. And their job was to witness and to, you know, speak back. And that seemed to be, there seemed almost not a, you know, magic circle around them, but there was a sense of journalism was to be protected because they were there just to stand by. And now it seems very different.
Well, it's
targeted.
Already a bestseller.
It is.
Yeah,
yes,
look forward to reading it. Thank you very much, Sarah.
Thank you so much.
Well, if you want to know more about today's guests, go onto our website, www.ratansiaandridley.com. And don't forget, we're also on Twitter and Facebook.
See you all at the same time, same place next week.